According to the latest available data from the Justice Department in 2014, the suicide rate in United States jails was at its highest point in at least 14 years. That 2014 rate was more than three times higher than the suicide rate for the general population in the United States. I have two guests with me now who have looked closely at what can be done to prevent suicides in jails. Cameron Lindsay is a retired federal prison warden who now works as an expert witness in the field of corrections. Cameron, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And Margot Schlanger is a professor of law at the University of Michigan, focusing on prisoner civil rights. Margot, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So, Margot, let's start with you. We know that there are differences in the suicide rate in prisons and in jails. So let's start with jails. Why is it so high?
Well, jails are about 70% pretrial. 30% of folks who are in jails are post-conviction, usually on more minor offenses. But compared to prisons, jails are the place where people go when they're having very serious shocks to their lives. Very seriously bad things are just now happening to them. So situationally, it's a much more dangerous time. In addition, people are much more likely to have current drug and alcohol issues. Jails are much more chaotic and tend to be less well run than prisons. And finally, jail officials know a lot less about the inmates than prison officials do because jails are they're so much more short term. They're churning population.
So, Cameron, you've worked as a warden in three prisons and two jails over the course of your career. So when an inmate is brought into a facility, what did officers look for to assess their risk of suicide?
Well, they perform an intake every time any inmate comes into a correctional facility. Frankly, I think it could be a little more extensive at times. Our jails and prisons are in serious need of change. I personally believe our entire criminal justice components need to be evaluated, the police, the courts, the corrections. But yes, when inmates come into the system, they are evaluated, but frankly, it's typically cursory, and they're going through arguably the most traumatic incident in their entire lives, being incarcerated straight off the streets. That's when people are most vulnerable for suicide in jails. I completely agree with everything that the professor mentioned.
What's the determination to put someone on suicide watch at that point?
Well, an inmate can be placed on suicide watch for a multitude of reasons. It might be a self-report of depression. It might be a staff observation where the inmate's in a corner crying. I mean, it could be a number of things, but the decision to actually put an inmate on suicide watch, at least in the federal system, is made by the chief psychologist of the facility, who's also the suicide prevention program coordinator. Anytime an inmate is put on suicide watch or the decision is made to remove them from suicide watch, again, it's the decision of the chief psychologist, but it must be with the concurrence of the warden.
Margot, based off of what Cameron just said, how often is it that an inmate could fall through the cracks?
Well, I think it happens fairly often that inmates are not put on suicide watch. I think the key, though, is to remember that it's not an all or nothing kind of a decision. A good system ought to have at least two levels of supervision for people who are at elevated risk of suicide, a level of close observation and then a level of constant observation. Constant observation 24/7 is onerous both for the facility and, frankly, for the inmate. And it's expensive and it's intrusive. It's reserved for people who are, you know, actively suicidal or close to it. But there's a level below that of close observation where people ought to be under staggered kinds of checks and ought to be in suicide-resistant cells, even if they're not in constant observation. It happens very, very often that systems don't have the setup for close observation that they need for people who are at an elevated risk of suicide, but not actively suicidal. There needs to be training both on just the basic idea that suicide prevention is part of a correctional officer's job and that it can succeed. There's a real attitudinal problem. The sentence that you'll hear occasionally is, look, if a guy wants to kill himself, he's going to kill himself. And it just isn't true. Suicides can be prevented in jail, and people need training to understand that actually suicide prevention can be very successful.
Cameron, it's a difficult question to ask, and we don't have to get into the details on how something like this is carried out, but It doesn't feel easy or simple to be able to take your life when you're in prison or jail. I mean, you're being monitored all the time. There are cameras everywhere. So the question is, how hard is it?
It's not. It's simple. An inmate can kill him or herself within minutes. So many folks think that somebody has to be hanging from a ceiling, or there has to be some protuberance from the ceiling where someone can tie off to and asphyxiate themselves. It's much simpler than that. Inmates can kill themselves with a t-shirt, a sheet, a pair of underwear, and they can tie off to the bunk bed and just lean forward on their knees until they pass out and then eventually asphyxiate. Staff can't monitor inmates the entire time. I mean, inmates are required to be checked on once every half hour in a special housing unit.
You mentioned special housing units, and we know that Jeffrey Epstein, for example, was in the Metropolitan Correctional Facility here in Manhattan. What are conditions like in these sections of a facility like that?
Yeah, so once Epstein was pulled off suicide watch, he would have been removed from his health services specially designed suicide prevention cell and moved back into the special housing unit. As I said, he would not be under direct and constant supervision. And from my perspective, you don't take a chance with somebody like this. You take the conservative, safe route. You keep them on suicide watch until they leave the facility. It wouldn't have been indefinite. He was a pretrial, pre-sentence inmate. It would have been a matter of not too long a time before his case was adjudicated and the Bureau could have designated him to the facility of to serve his sentence.
Margo, in terms of determining whether someone is a suicide risk, we know that often the folks are placed in isolation, and alternatively, folks may be given an inmate, a roommate, or a cellmate, should I say, in something that's called the buddy system. Do we know whether either of those has a positive or negative impact on one's ability or likelihood of committing suicide?
As I said, you really don't want this to be an all or nothing determination. And what it sounds like is that that's the way it was treated here. So even if somebody is on 24/7 constant observation, there are a number of systems that provide some of that observation by way of another inmate, usually not a cellmate, usually outside the room, but it's an inmate doing the watching. That's best used as a supplement, but it has been shown to be quite effective. But even if somebody's not on constant observation, there's a huge risk factor for suicide of isolation. And so if somebody is at an elevated risk of suicide, you don't want them in solitary confinement if you can possibly avoid it. And also you don't want them on half-hour checks that are at even half hours. You want them on staggered checks every 10 or 15 minutes, but no more than every 10 or 15 minutes. And you want them in a suicide-resistant cell, even if they're not on 24/7 constant observation. As Cameron said, a regular bed poses a very significant risk of facilitating suicide. But it's not rocket science to make a bed that doesn't have a way that you can hang yourself from it. It's not that complicated. And you can make suicide-resistant cells that are in special housing units so that people can be housed in special housing units longer term and not have these easy avenues to kill themselves.
Cameron, I want to bring you back in here because I don't want to sound conspiratorial here, but I wonder if, given the lack of federal oversight for a lot of state and county jails and facilities, I think of the case like Sandra Bland, who was pulled over by police and then just didn't make it out of the cell, and she was said to have died by suicide in the cell. How do we know, Cameron, how does the public know that these are in fact suicides, that these are not altercations with COs, that they aren't illnesses gone awry or untreated? How does the public know that in fact these numbers are accurate?
Well, they don't. And sometimes it's proven to be that they are in fact accurate. So, you know, there's just so much work that needs to be done with our systems of justice. You know, there really is no single criminal justice system. We have a compilation of police, courts, and corrections at the local, state, and federal levels. They're kind of all doing their own thing. There really is no particular system, but it's just super important to realize, I believe, that we need reform in our systems to include corrections, certainly, and I certainly recognize that.
Margo, what specific policy reforms do you see that could help decrease the jail suicide rate?
I think for decades, the Justice Department itself has sued city and county jails and settled those lawsuits by implementing a set of pretty simple reforms that deal with identification and assessment and observation, housing, mental health treatment, emergency response, and training. There's not a one step that solves the problem, but it's not rocket science. It's a protocol that addresses jail suicide, that addresses those six factors, and it works. And so what has to happen is that jails have to take that stuff seriously and implement it, and that includes the federal jails.
Cameron Lindsay is a retired federal prison warden and the author of Triple Deuces, A Day in the Life of an American Correctional Worker. And Margot Schlanger is a professor of law at the University of Michigan. Thanks to you both.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? And maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.